So we're on Daf Yud Aleph Amud Aleph, and you may recall that on the top of Yud Aleph Amud Aleph, we came to the conclusion yesterday that the Dayanim, the judges that make up the Beis Din for Ibur Shana, to add another month to the year, that's seven judges. They have to be invited. They cannot push themselves into the Beis Din without an invitation. And not only that, the invitation has to come from none other than the Nasi. The significance of adding another month to the year is so great that it comes on the top of the agenda here. It requires the greatest leader in Klal Yisrael to make that decision. And he gathers together judges. And that's Rabbi Gamliel in this case. He's the Nasi. And he'll invite the judges. That's called Mizumanim. That's the first word on the page. And the Gemara tells a story which is really a reflection of the greatness of Shmuel HaKatan, who would, at great self-sacrifice, in essence to embarrass himself in order to protect one of his colleagues from being humiliated. When Rabbi Gamliel finds that there are eight people there and he knows that somebody pushed himself in and he wasn't invited, so Rabbi Gamliel makes the statement, the one who is uninvited should stand on 2 feet and check out. So Shmuel HaKatan says, well, I was the one who came in uninvited. That's the first part of the sugya, that Shmuel HaKatan was willing to embarrass himself and to take the blame so that the one individual who was guilty would not be embarrassed. But then we get to the second part of the sugya, which we discussed yesterday. Now, how could it be, if Shmuel in fact was invited, then if he offers himself as the one who is kilu not invited, then he checks out, so the one who is not invited is now left in the Beis Din, and then Shmuel HaKatan is causing a situation in which the Beis Din is going to issue a decision about Ibur HaShana with a member of the court who's not mizuman, he wasn't invited, and therefore we don't really have seven judges. So yesterday we ended the shiur with the whole discussion with the Marsha, that maybe in fact there were actually seven judges that were invited, and there was no one uninvited. Rav Gamliel thought that the shliach, he sent out a shliach to bring in the invitees, and he thought that the shliach would bring in six, because he, Rav Gamliel, would be the presiding judge here. He would be the seventh judge to make up the seven. And if the shliach made a mistake, and he took Rav Gamliel literally when Rav Gamliel told him to gather together seven judges, so that's exactly what he did. He gathered together seven judges, and it turns out that now there are eight judges there. Now, Rav Gamliel thought in his mind, says the Marsha, that certainly the shliach would have been intelligent enough to realize that he was meant to gather together not seven judges, but six judges, and that the sum total would be seven, meaning that Rav Gamliel would be one, and then we were inviting another six. So Rav Gamliel's mind, what the shliach probably did was he invited another six, and yet there are seven, which means there's an extra body over here. So therefore, Rav Gamliel came to the conclusion that there must be someone who is uninvited. Now Shmuel HaKatan wants to spare that person who was uninvited of the humiliation of having to stand up and pack his bags. So what Shmuel did was, he left, pointing the finger at himself as if he was the one who was uninvited. But in truth, what the shliach did, and only Shmuel was aware of this, is he invited seven people because he took Rav Gamliel literally. And by inviting seven people, they were all mizumanim. So when Shmuel leaves, when he checks out, he's left with six dayanim plus Rav Gamliel. We have actually a Beis Din of seven mizumanim, and hence we can be ma'abra the shon. That's what we discussed yesterday. The Gemara now points out, v'lo Shmuel HaKatan hava. So let's see if we can find the place now We're on Daf Yud Aleph Amud Aleph. And where are we? Velo Shmuel Akaton. Just 1 second. It's approximately 10 lines down from the top. And the first word in the line is Shmuel. Do you see that? I mean, if somebody can count the lines, so it's about 10. So you say, it says Velo Shmuel Akaton. No, Shmuel Akaton, in fact, was not uninvited. Ela Inish Achrina. It was really someone else, because the shliach had invited only 6 people, and really all told it was 7, and one person pushed himself in. Umachmas kisufa. So the key word here in Aramaic is kisufa. Kisufa means embarrassment. So umachmas means because of kisufa, because of not to embarrass someone, who the other. That's why Shmuel offered himself to blame. Let's also keep in mind, before we go on to the next story in the Gemara, that Shmuel gave Rabbi Gamliel a certain excuse. You see, if Shmuel would just point a finger at himself and confess that he had pushed himself in, on one level, that could satisfy Rabbi Gamliel, because he now, you know, found the culprit, so to speak. But on the other hand, it looks really bad for Rabbi Gamliel to be choshed b'ksherim, so to speak. So what Shmuel did was, he accomplished 2 things. On the one hand, he took the blame for being that extra body there. But on the other hand, he gave Rav Gamliel some sort of a justification for why he did what he did. And Rav Gamliel was so touched by that, that he actually invited Shmuel to remain in the courtroom. And the poskim wanted to derive from this that even if someone is uninvited, if he remains in the courtroom, as long as he doesn't stand up to vote when they finally issue the ruling, then the decision of the Beis Din is binding and it's valid, despite the fact that there's extra baggage in the room. There were meant to be 7 judges and there are actually 8. So what did Shmuel tell Rav Gamliel to justify why he pushed himself in? And the answer was, he says that I wanted to learn. Loli Abras Hashana Lisi, I didn't come to actually be part of the decision-making process here, but Lilmod Halacha L'maisa. I needed to learn Halacha L'maisa. This is the famous principle that you all are familiar with, called Shimush Talmidei Chacham. And Shimush Talmidei Chacham doesn't mean what you think it means. You know, literally it translates as serving a Talmud Chacham. That's not what Shimush Talmidei Chacham is about. It's very nice to serve a Talmud Chacham and help him out, especially in Hasidic circles. That's like a great thing. But Shimush Talmidei Chacham, it means to watch the Talmidei Chacham, to see how they act, how they behave, how they respond, how they answer questions that come up. And that's what Shmuel wanted. He wanted to get the experience of an apprentice to learn, because as we're going to see in the next couple of Black Gemara, it's very complicated to decide when and whether we should add another month to the year. That's not a simple matter. It's very complex. And therefore Shmuel said, I pushed myself in because I wanted to observe and learn the halacha lemaisa. So that's called Shimush Talmidei Chacham. So Rav Gamliel was so touched by this that Shmuel took it upon himself to come into the Beis Din, knowing that it might be a very touch and go situation, but he did it because he had to learn the laws of Ibra Hashanah. So therefore shave bini shave, and Rav Gamliel bestows a great blessing upon Shmuel that he will be a major factor, an agent in bringing about Ibra Hashanah for years and years to come, possibly for all posterity, because maybe Shmuel would set new patterns and those patterns would be followed during the course of Jewish history. Now we're up to the word ki, or ki ha. Now the words ki ha mean, I'm going to tell you another story, and the second story is going to reflect the same idea as the first. So ki ha, like this one. The Yosef Rebbe. So now we're going forward, we're moving forward in Jewish history, and we're going to the period of the end of the period of Tannaim. Rabbi Gamliel is sort of like in the middle, but now we're fast forwarding to Rebbe, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. The Yosef Rebbe V'Kadarish. Now, by way of introduction, I have to say the following. this entire sugya that started with Rabbi Gamliel, now we go on to Rebbe, and then it's going to take us to Rabbi Meir. This entire sugya is based on what I call situational ethics. Are you familiar with that phrase? I mean, this is, you know, if any of you have ever studied ethics or moral philosophy, that there's something called situational ethics. Situational ethics means that you find yourself in a conflict between two great ethical ideals. Now, in halachic terms, what are these two ideals, these halachic principles that clash, and you have to sort of navigate your way through this clash? On the one end, we have a principle called Zrok Mora B'Talmidim, which means throw the fear of the Lord into the hearts of your students. Just like I know everyone in this classroom is very scared and they shake before they come into the classroom, right? Yeah. So there is, I'm just joking with you. But what I mean is to say there is a concept of taking harsh discipline with regard to the Rebbe-Talmud relationship. And the reason for that is because the Torah itself has to be given, has to be received, b'zeah u'bepachad u'beyira. The Torah is given out of a sense of fear. You know, there's an element of fear in the giving, the transmission of Torah. That Har Sinai, it was kafalev akigigis, it was bereses u'beyem u'beyira. And that's the way the Torah should be transmitted. You know, people who come into a shir and they sit back on, you know, on their laurels and they say, entertain me, Rebbe. You know, that's not the proper attitude. And the Chachamim were very careful about this. And Rebbe is going to be a perfect example. He's going to try to instill a certain fear in the hearts of the students that they should behave absolutely properly, you know, 100% without any failure whatsoever in the way they behave in a classroom. I was told, again, I wasn't there, that my Rebbe once gave it to somebody who started yawning in the middle of class. And he started yelling at him, "Why do I bother you?" You know, he said, he had an accent, my Rebbe. So, you know, again, you know, some people would say that's abuse. You know, today we call that abuse, right? But in the context of Chazal, that was a very important principle in transmission of the Torah. You have to have respect for the Rebbe, and especially for the Torah that he's teaching. And there's no room for hanky panky here. You know, there's no room for a laid back attitude. We saw that in Rabbi Gamliel. Rabbi Gamliel wanted to know who pushed himself in and was not invited, and that was from Gamliel's midah, his characteristic of Zrok Mora B'Talmidim. And we're going to see it now in Rebbe. Because one of the Talmidim did something offensive, and Rebbe wants to know who is it. He wants to know who's the one who's guilty of this, and Rebbe is willing to berate him publicly if need be for doing something that steps out of line. Now that's one ethical principle. There's another ethical principle, and that's called Hamalbim Prechaver Barabim is Keilu Shofech Damim. That if a person humiliates someone publicly, It's as if he murdered him. You know, the face of a person who's humiliated turns red. That's like indicative of something's wrong with the flow of his blood. You know, his life is at stake. And there's even a Gemara that says that Noach lo lodom shiapol atzmo l'kiv shenesh v'al yalbin es p'nei chaver. It's better to jump into a furnace than embarrass someone. And the Gemara tells stories about various gedolim and Chanina ben Dosa and others who really did that. You know, they would jump into a fire rather than embarrass someone. So how do we balance these two ethics that in the classroom they really come to a head-on collision? And you'll find that some Chachamim will bend and tip the scale in favor of Chas v'Shalom not humiliating anyone, and other Chachamim will say no. When it comes to the laws that govern behavior in a classroom, we're going to take it all the way. There's no flexibility. There's no compromise. So we had the first story of Gamliel. Here's another story of Rebbe. Rebbe is teaching a class in the Beis Medrash. Ve'hiriach reach shum. And basically, the dentist will tell you this is a plug for brushing your teeth in the morning, or using Listerine, or whatever your favorite mouthwash is. So the man ate garlic. Garlic has a very strong odor, and it's very offensive to other people. I had an experience once where it was very hot, and I was sweating, and I was sitting in a class, and I took off my watch, because I don't know if you have this experience, but sometimes if you're really, you know, sweating, perspiring, the watch really interferes. Now, as a result of my taking off the watch, unbeknown to me, there was a certain odor that went on. And this is not my Rebbe, Reb Salvech, but somebody got very offensive. You know, it smells over here. Now, whether Rebbe was well calculated and thought out here, I don't know, but Omar, he declared, Mishach al Shum, whoever ate the garlic, let him pick up, you know, stand up on his feet, Yetzeh, and let him leave the Beis Medrash. Now, you can imagine what it would be if you were the guy who had bad breath, and you had to stand up and leave. That's pretty humiliating, is it not?
Oh, yeah.
But as I said, Rebbe is applying the Midas HaDin, you know, the strict justice here, and the law requires that students behave properly. This is improper behavior on the part of a student. Amad Rebbe Chia. Rebbe Chia here represents the Midah of humility. He stands up, v'yatza. He wasn't the one who ate the garlic, but he didn't want to embarrass the person who ate it. And now I say this with a chill, amdu kulam v'yatzu. The entire Beis Medrash packed out. And basically that was a show of alliance. You know, the students were sort of rebelling against Rebbe in favor of Rebbe Chia's rebellion, because Rebbe, this is not what this is not, you know, with all due respect, you're the Rebbe, but we can't, this is not the way a Jewish Rebbe has to behave. You want to teach a class, you'll teach it to an empty room. No one is there. Amdu kulam v'yatzu. B'shachar, in the next morning, Mitza'o Rabbi Shimon b'Rebbe, the son of the Rebbe, that's Rabbi Shimon, found Rabbi Chia. Amale, and he says to him, Atohu ches tzi'arto li ava. You're the one who got father angry. Right? In other words, you were the one, and you claimed that you admitted the truth that you ate the garlic. Amalo, he says, no, I didn't eat the garlic. Chas v'sholem that I should eat garlic and go into the Beis Medrash, into the place where Rebbe's teaching. But lo kazos tehei, lo tehei kazos b'Yisrael. I'm not going to willing to tolerate this kind of embarrassing, humiliating someone, a member of the Jewish community, in public, that you're going to force somebody to leave. Now, there's machlokas mefarshim here. There are two ways of approaching and understanding Reb Shimon's criticism of Reb Chia. What does he mean when he says tziarto liava? So some approach it, and this is Rashi's pshat, that tziartes ava, you got ava upset because you reeked of garlic. How could you do such a thing? Others say that tziarto liava was not because of the garlic smell, but tziarto liava because he had to close his gemara and X out that day of shir, meaning there was no Torah being studied on that day. And according to those mefarshim, which the Marsha quotes, we have a very important halachic principle here, that even for Talmud Torah derabim, I'll explain what that means in halachic terms, that's extremely significant when the public is learning Torah together, even that has to go down the tubes for the sake of al yalbin es pnei chaver barabim. So there's one individual who will suffer humiliation, the entire tzibur, I don't know how many students were learning at Rebbe Shir, I have no clue, probably hundreds, they'll have to all give up and forfeit on the Torah study on the highest level with Rabbi Yehuda Nasi for the sake of avoiding humiliation of one individual. And that's what he says. So those are the two. Again, I'll just review it very quickly. There's one way of understanding that Rabbi Shimon was critical of Rabbi Chia because of eating the shum, because after all, it was Rabbi Chia who was the first one to leave. And the other interpretation was his critique was the gram of bittul Torah, bittul shiur, of bittul Talmud Torah de Rabbi. Now, just to give you an indication of the significance of Talmud Torah Derabim, you have to open up a Gemara Masechet Megillah, and the Gemara says that a number of things, but they're all based on the same principle, that although a person who's learning has to stop learning in order to hear the Megillah reading, but not so in the case of Talmud Torah Derabim. If the Rabbim are studying Torah, we're not going to undermine that learning for the sake of hearing the Megillah. The Gemara goes on to say over there, Masechet Megillah, if I remember correctly, that Yoshua was castigated by the Malach of Hashem because he was Mevatel Talmud Torah Derabim. And the source for Talmud Torah Derabim is a mitzvah, is a parasha in the Torah called Hakel, when we study Torah in public. And that's a mitzvah unto itself. So there's just a general mitzvah of Talmud Torah, and now you multiply it arithmetically, you know, how many people are going to miss that Torah. But then there's some sort of communal entity of Talmud Torah, which is a mitzvah unto itself, derived from Hakel, above and beyond Talmud Torah. So when the community is studying Torah, that's a great mitzvah that goes beyond regular Talmud Torah, and even Talmud Torah times whatever number of people are going to have to be mevatel. But yet, Rabbi Chiya insists that for the sake of avoiding humiliation, I'm not sure exactly what Rebbe was thinking, but at least Rabbi Chiya, we understand, he had some sort of a mesorah, let's say, some sort of tradition, that in order to avoid humiliation, we have to be mevatel even Talmud Torah Derabim. So the Gemara asks Rabbi Chiya Mehecha Gomirle. How did Rabbi Chiya know? Who taught Rabbi Chiya this principle that a person can take the blame, even though he's not to blame, in order to prevent someone else from being humiliated? Now, it could be that the underlying principle of this question is the following. Lo siya b'cha evyon, which means chayecha kod min l'chayecha vercha. When Rabbi Chiya stands up and he takes credit for being the one who ate the garlic, then if all things are equal, he's the one who's guilty. And he's really suffering the humiliation. And why? To prevent someone else from being humiliated. And we have a principle called chayecha kod min l'chayecha vercha. Do you remember this, Rabbosai? This is Gemara in Bat Metzia. You know, you're holding on to the water. You're in the desert. Mm-hmm. And the law is, we pass on like Rabbi Akiva against Ben Petur, that you drink the water. You don't give the water to someone else. Many poskim say you're not allowed to even give the water to someone else. Chayecha kod min. You know, it was hashgach that you have the water, you possess the water, you drink the water, and that's it. So how is Rabbi Chiya deriving this conclusion that he's going to embarrass himself rather than someone else be embarrassed? What about chayecha kod min l'chayecha vercha? And the Gemara answer is that Rabbi Chiya derived it from Rabbi Meir. In Sanya, we learned a very interesting case in a braisa. I wonder what the modern commentaries would write about this if they knew about this story. Yeah.
Chayecha kod min l'chayecha vercha. Is that life and death, or is embarrassment included?
In general, it's mamish goes straight across the board. You have $10 and you want to eat breakfast. You don't have to give up your $10 to a poor person. You need that $10 to eat breakfast. It's not a matter of life and death. It's a matter of allocating funds. You know, to what's called in English stucker funds, charity funds. Mm-hmm. It has implications in terms of, you know, let's say you have rights and perhaps responsibilities to be the Shliach Tzibur. You don't have to give that up for someone else, even though he wants to be the Shliach Tzibur. It's Chayecha Kodman. Again, there are a million rules and nuances, but in Jewish ethics, you come first if you have the ability to save yourself or pretend. So Gemara says that Rabbi Chiya had to rely on some great predecessor, and in this case Rabbi Meir, in order to come to his conclusion that he should volunteer that I'm the one guilty of eating garlic. Tisanya Maisa Beisha Achas Shebasa Lebeis Medrash Midrashel Shel Rabbi Meir. A woman shows up at the Beis Medrash of Rabbi Meir. She probably said, "Where's the Rosh Hashiva? I have something important to talk to him about." Right? She didn't have an appointment, but she knocks on his door. V'yomerlo, and she tells Rebbe, "Echad mikem, one of your students. These are your holy students, Rabbi Meir. Kidshani v'bia. He married me with kedushay bia. You know, a woman can be married off with kesef shtara bia." Now Chazal are very opposed to kedushay bia. The Gemara tells us the kedusha rav man gida man de makadish bia. If somebody went ahead and he took advantage of this third opportunity, third possibility of being makadish nish with bia, we're going to beat him up for that. That's called pritzus. The Torah accepts it and validates it, but we want to avoid it at all costs. Now, what she says to Rebbe, Meir, is the following. This student of yours has two choices. Either we live together as husband and wife, because he married me with Bia, or he has to give me a get. Where's the guy? Where is he? I know he's somewhere in your base medrash. Amad Rabbi Meir, stands up. V'kasav lo get krisus v'nasan lo. What does that imply if he gave her get krisus? He's the one, right? They used to say Nixon's the one. That was in my day. I'm dating myself. Okay. Amdu kulam v'kasvu kulam v'nasan lo. Every last student in the base medrash, I know this must have been a heyday for the sofer. The standard price today for writing again is close to 1,000 shekel. Now, I don't know how many students there were in Rebbe's class, but this was like, you know, this is a boon for the sofer. But anyway, so he writes a get on behalf of every single student. And why is this? In order not to embarrass that one person who was guilty of this pritzus, of this immodest behavior of being Makadish and Isha with beer.
But they had to pay the ketubah?
That's an interesting question. What about the ksuba? Let me think about that as we go along. I just wanted to add another point here. We'll get back to your point about the ksuba, Mrs. Shem. And the question is, where are the witnesses?
But she didn't really have a ksuba from any of all those people.
No.
Yeah, but if it was a marriage, then ksuba is what's called a t'nai bezdin. Meaning, even if you didn't get the document, right, once a person marries a woman, he has to pay the ksuba. That's a takonis chacham. L'chatchila, we want to write a ksuba so she'll have something to hold over him, that if he claims, "Oh, I paid you already," she'll produce the document. But even if there was no document, he still has to pay the ksuba. But let me ask you a different question before we get to ksuba, because I had a more basic question, I think. Where are the eidim? Where are the witnesses here? So there's a machlokas here in the Mefarshim where the witnesses are. According to one pshat now Gemara, she claimed that the witnesses took a long boat to China. That's called Yatsu Levedina Sayyam. And therefore, you know, there are no witnesses. But there are witnesses. There were witnesses. According to another approach in the Rishonim, we have a principle called Chazaka Ein Adam Osa Bilaso Bilas Nus. Okay, I don't know, maybe this is a little bit far away from our topic, so I'll just give you 30 seconds and then we go on, because this is not for us today. But suffice it to say that unless we have proof to the contrary, if a man and a woman in a Jewish context have a relationship and intimacy, then we assume that's for the sake of marriage. And there's another principle called Hein Hein Edi Yuchud Hein Edi Bia, which means if we have reason to believe that he had in mind Kiddushin, the Edom don't have to actually see, they don't have to actually see what's called Kimchol B'Shvafaras, the actual act. The knowledge that they're living together, that would be enough. But again, as I said before, we have a principle called Holchu Edom Lemedinas Hayom. Now, Chanoch, you asked me, would they each have to pay the ksuba? So that's an interesting question. Let me just think. We might have a principle here called Hamotzi Mechavero Olav Araya, which means the following. At this point, we cannot identify the person who had Bia and married this woman. Now, each one of the Megarshim here was Megarish Mitzad Sofek, as far as the law is concerned, she would need witnesses who went out to Medina Sayyam in order to prove her case as far as the Ksub is concerned. So the answer to your question is yes and no. What I mean by yes and no is yes, there's got to be payment to the Ksuba. But no, it's not that every one of these yeshiva bachrim have to give her the Ksuba. I mean, she would really become wealthy overnight. But no, that's not the case. We'll wait until she can prove with witnesses who is exactly the one who has to pay the Ksuba. Ask another question, can she marry a Kohen? I think the answer would be no, she cannot marry a Kohen, because by her own admission, she was married to one of these fellas. The Edom are out in Medina Sayyam. She now has a get, but she cannot marry a Kohen.
She couldn't marry Bechla. If she only had the get from Rabbi Meir.
Well, no, I'm saying Abdul Kulam. I'm saying that the Maskana that everyone got up and gave her a get. She's a Grusha because one of the people in that group was the Makadish.
But so just from the one get of Rabbi Meir, that get doesn't do anything.
Again, that would be complicated. If let's say Rabbi Meir would be the only one to give her a get, Well, then I think she might be an Eish Hashish. I don't know if she'd be able, because in such a case we apply the principle of Shavya Nafshi Chaticha Di Sura, and it'll only be after the Edom come back that we'll know to whom she's married. The Gemara's not happy for Rabbi Meir Mehecha Gomerlo. Okay, with all due respect, Rabbi Meir did this act, so to speak, taking blame for this marriage relationship, and he put his reputation on the line by writing her a get in order to prevent the humiliation of one of the Talmidim. But again, you know, where did Rabbi Meir get it from? So we have to assume that Rabbi Meir was standing on the shoulders of someone greater than him. And now we're going really back into history. Mishmuel HaKotan. Mm-hmm. Right, Shmuel HaKotan said, I was the one who pushed myself into the Beis Din, uninvited. Shmuel HaKotan Eichad Gomer Leh. You know, it's finally we're going to have to go back to the big boss. I mean, because he keep going back and back, right? So Shmuel, where did he learn it from? So he learned it from Shchanya ben Yechiel. Okay, this is a parsha in Ezra. Tichsiv Hayan Shchanya ben Yechiel b'bnei Elam v'yomer li Ezra. Okay, you have to understand there was a tremendous amount of intermarriage going on at the time of what's called Aliyah Shnia, meaning when Ezra gathered together whatever Jews he could to come on Aliyah to live in Eretz Yisrael. And rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, that's 70 years after the destruction of the first one. So what he found was, it was really, really hard to find Jews who identified as Jews. There was so much intermarriage going on. We think that intermarriage is a problem today. I was told that in Vancouver, Canada, I was told 10 years ago, the intermarriage rate is above 90%. This I was told 10 years ago, so I can imagine what it is today. And I know a young girl from Portland, Oregon, who comes from a very, very Jewish neighborhood. She's South African. She joined the conservative movement. Eventually she became Orthodox, and she married a tremendous Ben Torah. So she told me that in her neighborhood, if a Jewish man, or the other way around, right, would marry a Jewish girl, it would be by coincidence only. That was her language. Purely by coincidence. So we live in a generation of intermarriage, and some of them are even applying for the candidacy in the Democratic Party. Okay, right. So what is Shchanya? Apparently, was one of the leaders of the Jewish people at that time. He was a very religious Jew, and he tells Ezra, "Now listen carefully. Underline the word anachnu. Anachnu is not just the royal we. Anachnu means he included himself. Ma'alnu belokenu." And we married girls from the nations of the world. But now that we're coming back to Eretz Yisrael, yesh mikveh li Yisrael al zos. There's a mikveh, so to speak, in the figurative sense, where we could go into the mikveh and purify ourselves. The mikveh here is an allusion, is a symbolic representation of tshuva. And the word tshuva is always combined with the word tikva, tikva, not the national anthem, but similar idea, that we have a tikvah, you know, we have a belief that there's tshuva. Tshuva is the greatest message of optimism when a person thinks he's crossed all the red lines, you know, he's married to a non-Jewish girl, and now he's given the opportunity to do tshuva, but only if he's willing to come forward and say, anachnu ma'alnu. Now again, this Shchanya was a tzaddik. By the way, does anybody know anyone who, by the name of Shchanya? No, I don't know. For some reason, I never heard of Shchanya. You know, people are into Tanakhic names. It's a beautiful name. It comes from the Shorish, is the Shechina of God. That God rests on me, so to speak. He should rest on me. Yechiel is a common name today. In any event, this tzaddik takes the blame for it by including himself under anachnu ma'alnu, as if to say, as if to imply that he himself was guilty of marrying a shiksa, of marrying out of the faith. And the reason he said this was in order not to embarrass and humiliate those who were guilty of this sin. Now again, I'm not exactly sure why this case of Shchanya is so convincing, why the analogy is so appropriate. I would assume that in the case of Shchanya, we would be able to figure out who is intermarried and who is not. You know, the fact that he says, Anachnu ma'alnu v'noshiv nashim. But maybe what the Gemara is pointing out is that sometimes when you formulate your sentences and your words and you take blame, because we take your words literally, you're pointing an accusative figure at yourself, that itself is humiliating. And to formulate your words in that way, like for example, if Shmuel HaKotan is going to say, well, I'm the one who pushed himself in, Rabbi Chiya is going to say, I'm the one who ate shum, Rabbi Meir is going to give a get as if to say he was the one who married Habibia. I mean, in all these cases, what you're stating, what you're formulating is an outright lie. But moreover, what's more important is that you're implicating yourself in a crime, and we have to find the source for doing that. Who in the history of the Jewish people was a tzaddik who implicated himself in a crime, even though he wasn't guilty at all, just for the sake of avoiding humiliation? So that we find in the case of Shchanya ben Yechiel anachnu ma'alnu. Now Shchanya ben Yechiel meicha gomer lo. Oh, so now we have to go back to what I call the big boss. Who's the big boss? The Ribbono Shel Olam himself. So ultimately, Jewish ethics means imitatio Deo, that we have to imitate the Almighty. And the Gemara says the following. Mi Yoshua here means from the words of God to Yoshua. Dechsiv. Vayomer Hashem al Yoshua. God addresses Yoshua. Now this is after the battle of Ai in Yud. And if you remember, Yoshua had admonished the people, the military forces, that they should not take any booty. They should not enjoy the benefit of all the possessions. And one individual, his name was Achan, he actually stole from the booty and he violated the command of Yoshua. And as a result of the guilt of his crime, a number of Jews died in the Battle of Ai. I think it was 36. Who remembers how many?
36. Some say it's one.
Oh, some say it was one. So now, Hashem turns to Yoshua, and he says to him, Kumloch, lama ze'ata nofel al panecha, chata Yisrael. Meaning, this is not a time for mourning. This is a time for discovering who is guilty of this crime, because the perpetrator has to be brought to justice, has to be punished. And I made one mistake here. I just want to correct myself, just for the records. The violating the crime was in the previous battle. It was Achan who took booty from Yericho. There were two battles, one after the other. First was Yericho, and then was Ai. So the punishment of the loss of Jewish life at the time of the Battle of Ai was a result of the sin of Achan in the previous Battle of Yericho, where he took the booty and he was not allowed to do so. So now look what it says here. Hashem addresses Yoshua and he says, Chata Yisrael. Does he isolate the guilty or name the guilty party? No. So Amal Lefan of Yoshua responds, Ribbono Shel Olam, Mi Chata. You know who it is. Why do I have to go through this entire investigation, which is called Gorolos, we'll speak about that in a minute, in order to determine who is guilty and violated this mandate? Just tell me. Just give me his name. You know, right? If you don't want to say it out loud, write it on a piece of paper. Just give me his name. I'll know what to do with it. Amar lo, HaKadosh Baruch Hu responded, V'chei delatar ani. Now, delatar is someone who's guilty of lashon hara or rechilus, someone who spreads bad rumors and tells you bad things about people. God says, I don't fit that category. I'm not going to mention the name of the guy. This is your responsibility, Yoshua. You find him out. Lechatel gorolos. You will determine based on a gorol. You know, you're going to take a lottery, and somehow the lottery is going to fall on the person who's guilty, and you'll figure it out. But what you see from here is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not want to reveal the name of the sinner and embarrass him. Again, Klal Yisrael are considered as one entity, Chotim, and why does Hashem use that term, Chotim Yisrael, referring to the entire community of Israel, is because he didn't want to single out the guilty party and embarrass him. And if we go back to Shechaniah derived from this, just like HaKadosh Baruch Hu, after the battle of Ai, he says, Chotah Yisrael, so too Shechaniah says to Ezra, Anachnu Ma'alnu. Right? Anachnu Ma'alnu, meaning that the entire nation is guilty. Now, some of the Darshanim want to learn from this that the principle of Kol Yisrael, Arevim Zeh L'Zeh, goes very far. That we have mutual, interdependent responsibility. And that means that really, in a sense, Chata Yisrael, although there's one individual who actually perpetrated the crime, but the fact that one individual was able to do so is probably because the other members of the Klal did not have the proper attitude of having an impact on him and uplifting him. And in a sense, they are guilty as well. But the bottom line for our sugya, leaving out the darshanim, is that God, instead of singling out by name the sinner, he couches it in a general term, and all of Klal Yisrael is included under God's enunciation of Chata Yisrael. So we see how important it is to, instead of isolating by name the person who's guilty, but to try to reduce that humiliation by speaking in terms of the klal, and then we'll figure out later in private through a gorol who's the one who's actually guilty. E by sema, another answer to the question where is the original teaching from the boss on high, and that's Moshe. In other words, God addresses Moshe. Dichsiv, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says the following. Ad ona me antem. Okay, we're talking about the parasha of Man, and if you recall, God sends a mandate to the people through Moshe that on Fridays they should collect a double portion of Man and have reliance on Hashem, and instead of violating the Shabbos by going out to collect Man, very often the Man was out of the Machne, so you would have to violate Hotzah. So Hashem says, gather together a double portion of man on Friday, and that's going to last for two days. And the idea was, don't eat up all the man on Friday, because you need that man for tomorrow. So there's a message for me, because I was thinking this Friday of having two meat meals, you know, before we go into the 9 days. Anyway, he says what they did was they didn't have faith in God, they violated the Shabbos, they were absolutely frightened that maybe they wouldn't have enough man to sustain them on Shabbos. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Ad ona me antem. Now here we have to add another point. The Pasuk says, describing the violation, Yatsu min ha'am lilkod. Min ha'am means that a number of individual members of the people went out to collect on Shabbos. Who are these individuals? Let's identify them. But instead, Hashem doesn't want to identify them. He says, Ad ona me antem. In a general sense, he doesn't want to single out the names of those members of Bnei Yisrael who sinned And the reason for that is because God didn't want to embarrass them, and therefore he couched it in general terms, ad ona me'antem. Okay. Now, there were a few points that I wanted to make. Yeah. First of all, I wanted to make a point here about the story of Rabbi Chiya, right? The story of Rabbi Chiya, where she claimed that one of the students was Makadisha Bibir. And what did Rabbi Chiya do? No, I'm sorry, this is Rabbi Meir. Did I say Rabbi Chiya? I meant to say Rabbi Chiya learned it from Rabbi Meir, that Rabbi Meir, instead of... just one second... Just one second. Give me a minute here. I'm sorry. Right. Just one second. So that's that. So what was the Marsha's kash that I wanted to share with you? Oh. The Marsha asks the following question. Let's see if we can piece this together. Minayin la gemara shekol echad lomad zos mi mishu acher. Why not skip the whole Chagadya here? If God Himself teaches us that you don't single out someone who's guilty and embarrass him, so why does the Gemara say that Rabbi Chiya was standing on the shoulders of Rabbi Meir? Rabbi Meir was standing on the shoulders of Shmuel. Shmuel was standing on the shoulders of Shechaniah. And Shechaniah learned it from the Ribono Shel Olam. I mean, why not cut to the chase, as we say? If the source of all our ethical principles it rests in the Almighty Himself, so why do you have to say that each Chacham was relying on the Chacham who came before him? It's a Gvaldika Kasha, no? Does anybody empathize with this Kasha? I mean, to me, this is like it's like basics. I'm kicking myself why I didn't ask this question.
But there are times when
Kosh Baruch
Hu does single out people.
All right, so I'll get to your kasha, but that's not going to help me answer the Marsha's kasha, I don't think, unless you... But the Marsha's asking, if we do have, the Gemara's presenting the thesis that we have a basis here to derive this from the Ribono Shel Olam, is Madua Hutzuchu Kol Echad Lulmot Zeh Mizeh? Why does each one have to learn from the other one? Just go straight to Kodesh Baruch Hu. Kodesh Baruch Hu is talking to Moshe, and he's talking to Yoshua. That should have been a sufficient derivation. He says the following: Achen, Yechol Ha'isa Gemara Lomar Kin El Nokto Lefi Seder Adoros Lashmienu Sha'af Lomdu Zos Ish Merayev. Again, I can just translate the words for you. I'll throw the ball to your court to figure out what this means. But he's saying that in Chinami, the Gemara from the get-go, you know, from the start, when we asked how did Rav Chiya do such a thing, the Gemara could have right away answered from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is Moshe and Yoshua. But the Gemara wanted to show and demonstrate that there's something called Seder HaDoros, which means that you derive something from the Friya Dikadar, from the generation of Chachamim that came before you. That's what the Gemara wanted to demonstrate.
That's
from the Sora. So I was thinking the following. Do you remember that we once discussed the issue of Ein Morin Halacha Bifnei Rabo? Do you remember this? I'm trying to remember where it was, on what daf. But anyway, that it's not right for a person, even if he's a scholar, to offer a verdict or a ruling in halacha in the presence of his Rebbe. Which means that, you know, it could be that you know the halacha, but, you know, halacha is very complicated, especially in the field of ethics. There are so many nuances and to balance and the pluses and the minuses. Don't take it upon yourself if your Rebbe's around. Ask your Rebbe. You never know, he may come up with a different perspective. And not only that, it's insulting to your Rebbe in the fact that you decided the case without asking him. So again, I'm not sure how to how that principle jars with our sugya, because Rabbi Chiya is a Talmud of Rebbe. He's sitting there in the shir, and Rebbe says, "I want to know who's guilty of being insensitive to the Torah study." And he's eating shur, and Rabbi Chiya says, "It's me. I don't want to humiliate someone." But why didn't he ask Rebbe? Maybe he should have bent over and whispered to him. I don't know. So now I'm not sure if that, how to answer that, how to orchestrate that. But this idea of the Seder Adoros, that we don't just decide that this is what the Rabbi Shalom had in mind, and therefore we make it into a klal. We have to see in a real life situation, what do they call it, in live time, is that the phrase? How the Chachamim dealt with that situation. And we need some sort of a relying on one dar and that dar and the previous dar. So that's called Shimush Talmidei Chachamim. Then he says the following. He says, Yitochen, it's possible, Shekulam Nagu Misvara, at every level in this Gemara is Minolan, right? Minog Gmiralan. What's the language of the Gemara? Mehecha Gomerle. Why Mehecha Gomerle? What's the compelling premise here that they were deriving it from some source? Maybe they were just based on what we call Svara. The Halacha relies not only on Psukim, but also on Svara. So he says, Mistavra, if you only have Svara, lo hoylem lasos ken. Because yesho Svara fucha. And what is that? So I told you before that I believed it was chayecha kod min l'chayecha vercha, but he says even better than that. He says that this chayecha kod min is because ein li odom lahachzik es atzmo kechote. That a person, just like he's not in control of his own body, right? Let's say a person wants to chashom commit suicide, the halacha doesn't recognize that. And so too, this is kind of like spiritual suicide. If a person makes a public declaration that he's a chote, that's not acceptable. Even for the sake of shol yivayish acherim. V'kolshken she'en l'adam lichol es chaveru im chotim, and how much more so he shouldn't include others together with him as sinners, in order to avoid the embarrassment of one person. So in each one of these stories, he really included himself and others, because if Rabbi Meir is going to give a get, then all the other Talmidim are going to give a get. And if Shmuel, what was the case of, what did I leave out here? If Rabbi Chiya is going to stand up and say that I'm the one and I and pack out, then everyone else is going to pack out. And then in case in Shechanya, he says that anachnu ma'alnu, and he includes everyone. So that's not acceptable based on svara alone, that you can include others in guilt in order to stave off the humiliation of one individual. Omnam, however, midivrei HaKadosh Baruch Hu leMoshe v'Yoshua roim anu shekolal es kol bnei Yisrael, right? Chote Yisrael means the whole klal. Then you can even include others as chotim in order to avoid. Basically, the thesis of this whole sugya, in one word, is busha. That's the subject of this the heading. Okay. Tana Rabbanan, we learned in Ebraisa, Mishamesu Neviim Achronim, who are the last of the three Neviim? Chagai, Zechariah, Malachi, Nistalka, Ruach HaKodesh. There was no longer nevuah in Klal Yisrael. V'afal pichei, nevertheless, hayu mishtamshim bebaskol. They did rely on a heavenly voice. Now, why is it called a baskol? It should be called a kol min hashamayim. What's a baskol? So the Mefarshim write that a baskol is not something that you hear directly, but rather it's an echo of a voice. So one voice echoes, and then they hear the echo. And yet, they would rely even on the echo. Hamachas hayimisumim valias beis Guria biyericho. So there was an individual by the name of Guria, and he had an attic in Yericho. And v'nitna aleihem baskol min ha-shamayim, they heard a baskol. And the baskol announced the following: Yeshkan, there's some person here in this gathering, in this assembly, sheroi shetishol of shchina, that he deserves that the shchina should be shor on him. So even though we're talking about the period beyond the vim, he really could have been a navi. But the reason why he's not a navi is el she'ein doro zakai lekach, that the generation itself is on such a low spiritual level that the Shekhinah cannot appear and preside in this generation, and therefore there's no nevuah. So who is it? Again, it's a similar situation to what we saw before, that we don't know who to single out, but in this case we're singling out someone for greatness. Nasnu chachamim behil azokin, they all turn to Hillel HaZaken. Now Hillel HaZaken was one of the greatest Tanoim that we have, especially with regard to Midos. That's why the Gemara was critical of Hillel. You know, on one occasion Hillel rammed it into them and he said, why did you forget the law? You weren't careful about studying the law. Because Hillel, on his level of anava, of humility, he had overstepped his bounds. But Hillel really is the paradigm, the personification of humility. Ukshemes, when Hillel died, Amrul of the Hesped was Hey Chassid Hey Anav. He was super pious and very meticulous about his observance in every single way, but he was also an Anav. He was a person who personified humility, Talmido Shel Ezra. And he derived his great midos from Ezra. Now, the Marsha points out that it's impossible, historically, chronologically, that Hillel would have been a Talmud of Ezra. But what happened is, Ola mi-bavel v'talmuda bi-yado, the Gemara wants to create a similarity between Hillel and Ezra. Just like Ezra came up from Bavel to Eretz Yisrael with all his great wisdom and his scholarship, so too Hillel, according to Marsha's pshat, came up from Bavel to settle in Eretz Yisrael with all his great wisdom. But Hillel personifies these midos of Chassid, of Chassidus, and Anova, and that was Ezra. So in that sense, Hillel is a duplicate of Ezra in the personification of these great midos. The Gemara seems to imply that Nevuah depends upon three ingredients. Number one, that the Dar has to be Zakai Lekach, the generation has to be Roy. Number two, that the individual Navi has to be a Chassid. And number three, that he's got to be an Anav. And Hillel had two out of the three, but unfortunately he didn't have the Dar. Now why was it critical for the Baskol to make this announcement? So B'li Neder will cover that tomorrow. I just want to fit in so we get to the end of the sugya. Shuv pamacha so you misubim ba'liyas yavne v'nitna aleihem baskol min ha-shamayim yeshkan echad sheroi shetishre olav shechina el she'ein doro zakoi lekach. Once again, they heard the baskol that somebody sitting in this assembly room is on such a level he should have nevuah. They all assume unanimously, agree that it was Shmuel HaKotan. Ukshemes, when Shmuel HaKotan died, Amru Olav, Hey Chassid, Hey Anif Talmido Shel Hillel. So we're in a later generation, but once again, the greatest hesped you could give for a Chacham who dies is that he personifies these two character traits. He's a Chassid and he's an Anav. Hillel, in that sense, was a duplicate, so to speak, a replica of Ezra, and Shmuel HaKatan was a replica of Hillel. It means that Shmuel HaKatan personifies the midah of humility. By the way, the Gemara tells us in Brachos that they were looking for a candidate amongst the Chachamim to author the extra brach of La Malshinim Al Sisikva. And they decided that the best candidate would be Shmuel HaKatan. So my Rebbe used to say, because La Malshinim Al Sisikva is an attack, you know, that pleading to God to, you know, carry out His wrath and punish the Malshinim, those who are who are contrary to the Jewish people, the adversaries, and they appointed Hillel because Hillel, I'm sorry, they appointed Shmuel HaKatan because Shmuel HaKatan personified humility, and they knew that he would have L'shem Shemayim, that his intention would be pure, because a person who's humble doesn't write these kind of diatribes. Afhu Omer Vishasmi Soso. Now the Gemara wants to tell us that Shmuel was in fact a Navi. Again, he wasn't a Navi in the sense that he had a message to transmit to Klal Yisrael from the Ribono Shel Olam. That prophecy he couldn't achieve because his dor was even worse than the previous dor of Hillel. But he did have some sort of quasi-prophetic experience. And at the time of his death, there's a long discussion here why people have prophecy at the time of their death. But suffice it to say that he predicted the terrible deaths of the Haruge Malchus at the time of the Romans. And he told us that Shimon, meaning Raman Shimon and Rabbi Shmuel, who was, Rabbi Shmuel was the Kohen Gadol Lecharva, they will be killed by the sword, which actually took place many, many years later. V'chavroi L'ketola, and also their colleagues will be each put to death in a very cruel way, different kinds of cruelty. We'll read it, if Mashiach doesn't come, then we'll read it on Tisha B'Av. U'sha'ar Amal Abiza, and when the Churban is going to take place at the time of the Romans, then there will be Biza. Biza means total destruction, humiliation of the Jewish people. The Akan, Sagin, Asidin, Lemesi al Alma. There'll be many tzaros that will come upon the world. And the Al Yehudim and Bava, Bikshu Lomar came. When Yehudim and Bava, he was one of the greats of Klal Yisrael amongst the ten martyrs, when he was put to death, the people wanted to give him the same hesped, meaning Yeshua ben Bava was an imitation, a Talmud of Shmuel HaKatan, who in turn was a duplicate of Ezra. Ella, but they couldn't give the hesped. Nitrafa Hashah. It was such a terrible moment in Jewish history that they didn't even, they just wanted to bury him. The Baruch Hashem, the Romans allowed them to bury Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava. And that's what they did. The Ein Maspidim al Ruge Malchus. It's too dangerous to start giving Hespedim at the time that the enemies of the Jewish people are putting us to death, because you just have to take advantage of that one moment when they gave the license to bury him, and that's what they did. So Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava was buried without a Hespedim. Okay, Rav Osei, we'll stop here. So tomorrow we'll have to learn a little bit of astronomy. So Ruvain, I'm going to hold on to these so that they don't get lost. And maybe tomorrow Shia we'll start. If anybody's interested in the Iyun Shia, that'll be at 10:30.
Of course.